We are here this evening to present some of the results of our own personal research into this question of creation and evolution. Now, let me say just a word or two briefly about some of the books that we have. Much of the material that I will be presenting tonight and tomorrow on the origin of man is documented in this little book, Evolution, the Fossils Say No. And in this book, we do provide the documentation, as I mentioned, for many of the statements that we will be using tonight, and it includes a chapter on human origins. And then we have this book from our institute, Scientific Creationism. This is a general edition. I believe that's all we have here at this seminar. We do have a public school edition, which does not include the final chapter, which is a chapter on Scripture, creation and Scripture. But this is a general edition which does include that chapter. It's a comprehensive book on the creation evolution question. And then we have many other books. We have the book by Dr. Morris, Many Infallible Proofs, a book on Christian apologetics. I'm sure that many of you will be interested in. Well, this evening I want to direct our attention specifically to the fossil record. Now, tomorrow morning I'll be giving a lecture relating evolution, the theory of evolution, to the facts of science, to the laws of science, to the laws of thermodynamics and probability theories and so forth and so on. And at that time, I will give you some of my own observations why we are convinced that evolution is no more scientific than creation, and it is as intrinsically religious as is creation. We'll be dealing with those specific problems tomorrow. The nature of this question, the basic nature of the evolution-creation question. And we'll be dealing with some of the aspects of that time. So I'll try to launch right into our discussion of the fossil record tonight. The most critically important evidence as it relates to this question of creation and evolution is that which we find in the fossil record. As we will note, if evolution is true, we could make certain predictions as far as the fossil record is concerned. We could describe what we would expect that fossil record to show. On the other hand, if creation is true, if we thought about the question for a while, we could describe what we'd expect the fossil record to show if creation were true. And as we will see, these predictions are very different. And so it would seem to be a simple matter then for scientists to dig up the fossils, to study them, and to classify them, and then to decide on the basis of the fossil record which seems to be the more reasonable model or theory, that of creation or evolution. And indeed it should. But we're going to take a look at our two models, the creation and evolution model tonight, the prediction that we'd make on the basis of these two models as far as the fossil record is concerned, and then we are going to compare the known fossil record to the predictions of each model. Now, most of us, as we've come up through the public schools and colleges and universities, have been repeatedly told and indoctrinated in that evolution is a fact. That is, there are so many things that it successfully explains, and there's so much evidence that supports it, and there's so few contradictions that it should be accepted as a fact. Although, of course, we cannot prove any theory. We cannot demonstrate any theory to be a fact. But nevertheless, since so much evidence supports the theory of evolution, there are so few contradictions, we are told, that it should be accepted as a truth. On the other hand, we are told that creation is merely a religious concept, something that you accept merely on the basis of your faith. It's something that you accept as part of a dogma, of a religious dogma. There is no evidence, you see, one way or the other, as far as this concept of creation is concerned. Well, before the seminar is over, I certainly hope that you'll come to realize that these statements are far from the real truth. we're going to review some of that evidence tonight as far as the fossil record is concerned. Now, I've said that most people have been told that evolution is a fact, that there's hardly any reputable scientists who do not accept the theory of evolution. Well, as a matter of fact, ladies and gentlemen, there are literally hundreds and thousands of scientists who do not accept the theory of evolution. Now, it's quite true, those of us who do not are a minority. The large majority, considerable majority of scientists do accept the theory of evolution. Many, however, have never really investigated the evidence. I'm sure if you ask someone if they believe in creation evolution, if they say they're evolutionists, you ask them to describe the scientific evidence which demonstrates that evolution is a fact or true. And I'm sure most people will not be able to really describe the scientific evidence one way or the other. So there are many scientists today who've come to the realization that the scientific evidence actually contradicts the theory of evolution, and that the concept of direct spatial creation admirably correlates and explains the evidence related to origins. Now, let me just cite one example from the literature which demonstrates that certainly not all scientists are evolutionists, or at least there are some very prominent scientists today who are beginning to doubt some of the major aspects of the theory of evolution, some who we may not even call creationists. We are finding that more and more and more, and you'll hear me quote many of these evolutionists, we find that more and more evolutionists themselves, although they embrace the evolutionary philosophy, are beginning to doubt some of the basic tenets of Darwinism and of neo-Darwinism, the modern theory of evolution, and beginning to question some of these things that have been assumed for so long. For example, I have with me a copy of a book review that was published in the journal Evolution in volume 29, June of 1975. This review appears on pages 376 to 378 of this journal Evolution. This journal is the journal published by the Society for the Study of Evolution. The book review is a review of a book written by a French scientist called L'Evolution du Vivant. Now, if you've studied French, you know French, that's not a very good pronunciation. But in English, it means the evolution of life. It was written by Pierre P. Grasset. The review was written by Dr. Theodosius Dobzhansky, one of the world's leading evolutionists. Dr. Dobzhansky, in this review, on page 376, makes the following statement, quote, "The book of Pierre P. Grasset is a frontal attack on all kinds of Darwinism. Its purpose is to destroy the myth of evolution as a simple, understood, and explained phenomenon, and to show that evolution is a mystery about which little is and perhaps can be known." Now, one can disagree with Grasset, but not ignore him. He is the most distinguished of French zoologists, the editor of the 28 volumes of Traité de Zoologie, author of numerous original investigations, and ex-president of the Académie des Sciences. His knowledge of the living world is encyclopedic, unquote. So Dr. Dobzhansky says that this book by Grasset is a frontal attack on all kinds of Darwinism. And he says that this man, Grasset, is the most distinguished of all French zoologists. Now, here's not just a run-of-the-mill professor or run-of-the-mill scientist. Here is the most distinguished of all French zoologists who is making a frontal attack on all kinds of Darwinism. Listen to the closing sentence in Dr. Dobzhansky's review. He says, quote, "The sentence which Grasset ends his book is disturbing." Then he quotes the sentence. This is a sentence. "It is possible that in this domain, biology, impotent, yields the floor to metaphysics." Unquote. Now, what Grasset is saying, biology can't explain origin. It's impotent. It can't do it. And therefore, perhaps we have to yield the floor to metaphysics. Well, of course. What does he mean by metaphysics? Of course, he is then saying perhaps we do have to turn to creation, a supernatural explanation for origins. Well, we find then the most distinguished of all French zoologists is saying some of the things that creationists have been saying all the time. Some of the most cherished aspects of this theory of evolution, beginning to, the foundations are beginning to crumble, and we'll discuss some more of that aspects of the question tomorrow. But we want to deal tonight specifically with the fossil record. Now, may we have that first slide, please? And I think we can leave the lights on for the first couple of slides. Maybe we might want to dim those just a little bit for these first two slides, and then we want to turn them down a little bit more. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me say that I do accept the biblical record of creation. I believe the Bible to be God's revelation to man. I believe this account of creation in the book of Genesis is a description of simple historical truth. And I do accept that account. But I'm saying this. I'm going to lay aside the Bible. I'm going to put it aside. And we can say that setting the Bible aside, we can demonstrate that this universe was created, that had a creator, and as a matter of fact, it demands a creator. On the basis of what we know about known scientific laws, the laws of science, and natural processes, this universe could not have generated itself, nor could it have transformed itself from some primordial, chaotic state to the highly ordered and complex universe that we have today, peopled here on this planet Earth with these incredibly complex living things. It could never have happened. Not in billions of years, not in hundreds and thousands and billions of times billions of years. We are saying that this universe demands a creator and that it did indeed have a creator. So we can lay aside the Bible. As a matter of fact, as we lecture and debate across the United States and throughout Canada, New Zealand and Australia and places like that, we never quote the Bible, we never use it in any way when we're in the front of a college or university campus. We don't need it as far as demonstrating the fact of creation is concerned. The Bible is very important, extremely important. But we don't need the Bible to establish creation as a dogma, as a religious dogma. But it can be scientifically demonstrated that this universe did have a creator. So we are saying, according to our creation model. Now, ladies and gentlemen, here on this screen, I have described two general models, a creation model and an evolution model. Now, these models can be used in any schools, any universities, public or otherwise. You do not see any quotation from Genesis there or any religious literature of any kind. These are two general models. We call these scientific models. Although we'll demonstrate tomorrow that neither creation nor evolution are scientific theories. They do not satisfy the criteria of a scientific theory. But we can establish them as models. So we prefer to use these terms, models. Now here we find the description of the general creation model. We are saying that the universe and all that it contained were brought into being by the direct acts of a creator, using spatial processes which are not in operation today. That's why it is referred to as spatial creation. It involves spatial processes which are not operating right now in this world. We're saying that God the Creator created certain basic kinds of plants and animals. Now notice, we're not demanding the fixity of varieties or the fixity of species. We're saying that God created certain basic kinds. And these kinds have always been the same right from the very beginning. What we are saying is simply that bats have always been bats. Turtles have always been turtles. Snakes have always been snakes. Gorillas have always been gorillas. And men have always been men. Right from the very start. Now there has been considerable variation within the limits of these kinds. But never the origin of one kind from another. For example, starting with the mongrel dog, man has been able to derive about 200 varieties of dogs, from the 4-pound Chihuahua to the 180-pound Great Dane. We know for a fact that in that mongrel dog, in that mongrel population, there was a tremendous genetic potential or gene pool. There were a sufficient number of genes, variations, in the genes, in the genetic material, the gene pool, to give rise to these varieties of dogs. But all the dogs are interfertile. They're all of one single species. But we also know that the dog, Canis familiaris, will on occasion interbreed with coyotes and wolves and jackals. Now, they do not ordinarily interbreed, so they have been placed in separate species. But they can, and they do interbreed on occasions. So it seems to us most reasonable to assume that the original dog kind was sufficiently broad, the genetic potential was sufficiently great to allow the limited variation, or limited, really we shouldn't say change, a limited variation which has given rise to what we call dogs, the jackals, wolves, and coyotes. But what we are saying is that there is no evidence in the present world or in the world of the past that cats and dogs have arisen from common ancestors. Among the reptiles, for example, we are saying that the snakes and the crocodiles and the lizards and turtles are separate, distinct kinds. They have had separate beginnings. That they have not arisen from a common ancestor. We are saying that monkeys, that gorillas, the chimps, and men, humans, have arisen separately. They have been created separately. They have always been distinctly separate. One has not arisen from the other. But within the human kind, for example, we have the many races. And we will deal with the origin of races tomorrow in our discussion of human origins. Well, so there's considerable variation within each kind. But we are saying that each kind was separately and distinctly created. Now, we compare this creation model to the evolution model. Now, ladies and gentlemen, please, I am not implying that all evolutionists are atheists. I know for a fact they are not. I know many theistic evolutionists. Dr. Morris, the director of our institute, when he was in college, was a theistic evolutionist. After he devoted more study to the scriptures and to the facts of science, he became convinced that the theory of evolution could not be supported either from the scriptures or from science. Dr. Lane Lester, our representative down in Florida, he was a convinced theistic evolutionist about 5 or 6 years ago until he came into contact with some of our lectures and some of our literature, and he became a very convinced creationist, although he was a Christian at that time. But please understand, ladies and gentlemen, the theory that your young people are being taught in our colleges, in our universities, in our schools, is a purely mechanistic, naturalistic theory of evolution. God is not involved and God is not necessary in this process. It is strictly a mechanistic, naturalistic theory. According to this theory of evolution, our universe and all that it contains came into being through naturalistic, mechanistic processes, which can be ascribed to properties inherent in matter. Matter itself had this inherent capability of self-organizing itself and to transforming itself into ever higher and higher levels of complexity. So that the universe itself, the stars and the planets, came into being from some big cloud of dust and gas. The solar system arose. And here on planet Earth, life arose from the inanimate. And that first primordial cell then gave rise to all living things. Now, when I say that this is purely an atheistic theory, it's God is not involved, God is not necessary, by what authority do I say that? Simply this. The evolutionists are saying creation must be excluded. You cannot include creation in the science textbooks. You cannot bring it into the science classroom. You cannot bring it into any discussion of any scientific theory of origins, because that brings in the supernatural. That brings in God. That brings in theism. Science must exclude that. And so creation is out and must be kept out. It becomes self-evident then that theistic evolution cannot be tolerated nor admitted. Because, you see, theistic evolution also requires the activity of God. It brings in the theism. It brings in God. It brings in the supernatural. It, therefore, must also be excluded. The only thing that is admissible, according to their definition, is this materialistic, mechanistic theory of evolution. And as we'll see tomorrow, that is embracing a particular philosophy and religion. And that is what is being demanded, and that is what is being taught in our schools today. It is an atheistic, materialistic philosophy and religion that is being insisted on today. But certainly, the theory of evolution that is being taught is this mechanistic theory. Matter itself had this ability. Now, according to this theory, then, all living things have arisen from this single primordial cell. Now, they believe that life must have only arisen once. That is, most evolutionists, because, you see, we have these biochemical similarities that go throughout all living things. The same type of DNA and RNA and proteins are found in all living things. And besides, they will admit, most of them admit, that the probability of the origin of life is so very, very small that the possibility of it arising more than once, you see, would be rather incredible. So they say, most evolutionists say, all living things have arisen from this single primeval cell. Sometimes we call this the particles to people theory of evolution, and sometimes I refer to it as the fish to gish theory of evolution, as some of you know. When we use terms like that, you see, then we understand perfectly what we're talking about. We're not talking about minor variations and changes. Now, we do see variations, minor variations occurring in the world today. One of the examples that is very often cited by evolutionists is the example of the peppered moths. Here's evolution in action. H.B.D. Kettlewell, the British biologist who studied the peppered moths, said if Darwin could have lived to see this day, he would have lived to see the culmination of his life's work. Sir Gavin De Beer and others have called the example of the peppered moths the most striking example of evolution ever seen by man. What about this example? Well, back in about 1850, most of the peppered moths in the industrial areas of England were of a light speckle-colored variety. And as they rested on the tree trunks, the light-colored tree trunks, and the lichen-colored covered rocks and so forth, they were very difficult to see because their particular coloring provided almost perfect camouflage against this background. But among these peppered moths, which are called Biston betularia, there was a variety known as the melanic form or the carbonaria form. It's dark in color. And as these moths spread out their wings and rested on these tree trunks and rocks, they stood out very nicely. So, of course, the birds ate relatively much more of the dark-colored variety than they did the light-colored variety simply because they could find them much easier. And as a result, the dark-colored variety remained a very small proportion of these peppered moths. But with the onset of the Industrial Revolution, as the soot and contamination poured down the air, the tree trunks began to get darker and darker and darker. And soon, it was the dark-colored variety that was difficult to see. And the light-colored variety now stood out rather nicely against that background. So quite predictably, the birds began to eat more and more of the light-colored variety and fewer of the dark-colored variety. And there was a shift in population of these light-colored versus the dark-colored varieties. And today, they tell us that in the industrial areas of England, about 95 to 98% of these peppered moths are of the dark-colored variety. So we've seen a shift in population. And this has been called the most striking example of evolution ever seen by man. Well, then, man has really never seen evolution. Because, you see, in 1850, all of these moths were peppered moths, Biston betularia, and in 1976, they all remain peppered moths, Biston betularia. They haven't become bumblebees or mosquitoes or houseflies. They haven't even become a different variety of moth. They're still Biston betularia. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if that's the most striking example of evolution ever seen by man, man has never seen evolution. No, man has never seen any significant change at all within all the time we have been observing. But it is postulated. This is what has been postulated as occurring through time and will occur in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years in the future. Well, now here's a description of our two models. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we could make many predictions now on the basis of these two general models. We can make predictions concerning what we would expect to find in natural laws operating today. And we're going to take a look at those natural laws tomorrow. The laws of thermodynamics and the laws of probability. Very, very definitely, that evolution model demands certain processes operating in the present world right now. And the creation model would make other predictions. You see, we're going to take a look at those laws tomorrow. On the basis of these two general models, we can make predictions as far as the fossil record is concerned. Next slide, please. Now, here is the predictions that we would make on the basis of these two models as far as the fossil record is concerned. Now, if our creation model is true, then we would expect to find a sudden appearance in great variety of highly complex forms of life. If creation was true, we would expect to find complex plants and animals appearing in the fossil record abruptly. When I say abruptly, I mean here they are complete. No simple or more simple and more simple evolutionary ancestors. We would find a tremendous variety of the fossils of a tremendous variety of highly complex plants and animals for which we could find no evolutionary ancestors. Here they are, complex forms of life. Furthermore, if the creation model is true, we'd expect to find the fossils of the different kinds of plants and animals, but no transitional forms. We'd expect to find the fossils of turtles and of snakes and of lizards and of crocodiles, but no transitional forms between these different kinds. We'd expect to find fossils of the invertebrates, the soft-bodied animals, or animals that have the hard outer parts and soft inner parts, the animals with shells, the invertebrates. We'd expect to find fossils of the vertebrates, those animals that have internal skeletons, such as you and I, soft outer part. But we would not expect to find transitional forms in between. We'd expect to find fossils of fishes and fossils of amphibians, but no fossils of any transitional form in between. We'd expect to find fossils of reptiles and of birds, but no intermediate form. We'd expect to find fossils of apes and monkeys and man, but no transitional forms. We'd expect to find the fossils of the major kinds, the higher categories, the created kinds, but we would not expect to find fossils of intermediate forms. The gaps should be systematic. They should be systematic. Now, what about the evolution model? What prediction would we make on the basis of the evolution model? Well, the prediction would be quite different, wouldn't it? If evolution is true, we'd expect that the oldest rocks which bear the remains of living things that have fossils, that these rocks would contain fossils of the simplest forms of life capable of leaving a fossil record. And then as we search out successively younger strata, we'd expect to find a slow, gradual change of the simple forms into more and more complex forms of life. And if life started with this little simple primordial cell and has diverged into millions of species, we'd expect to find a tremendous number of transitional forms. Darwin said that on the basis of his theory, we should expect to find an almost innumerable number of transitional forms. Well, I see we have a little disturbance on the sound. We'll expect our technicians to take care of that shortly. We had, one time we read it to debate an evolutionist, and he got up to start his portion, and all of a sudden he got all the static and background, and he looked up, said he guessed he'd been praying to the wrong person or something like that. Well, anyhow, if evolution is true, now listen, we've got to find those transitional forms. There's no other way about it. Here we have a fish that supposedly evolved to an amphibian, requiring about 30 million years, during which time, for example, the fins of the fish slowly and gradually changed into feet and legs of an amphibian. Now, of course, many other changes would have to take place, but there's something we could look for. Slowly and gradually, the fins of the fish changed into feet and legs of an amphibian. You see, the number of transitional stages would be tremendous because the mutations or the changes in the plantar animal which leads to evolution only brings about extremely slight changes. Dr. Stebbins and other leading evolutionists are saying today that the mutations that are favorable and that are selected bring about almost imperceptible changes, or imperceptible. They're so slight that they're either imperceptible or almost imperceptible. So you see, it takes a tremendous number of these changes in a tremendous number of characteristics to change a fish into an amphibian. And most of these things happen that are bad. They're either lethal or they're bad, pathological. Only rarely do you get a beneficial change, and then that brings about a very slight change, you see, and you have to change so many characteristics that the number of intermediate stages would be enormous. And also, you see, at all times there's a considerable population of these intermediates. You see, according to evolution, the animal that is the most highly adapted, the animal that is selected by natural selection, is the animal that reproduces in larger offspring. The one that reproduces larger numbers of offspring. That's the very definition of natural selection. The animal or plant that reproduces in larger numbers, make the greatest contribution to the gene pool of succeeding generations, that is the creature that is selected and is evolving. So there'd always be a considerable population of these intermediates. Now, let's assume 30 millions of years of evolution from fish to amphibian. How many of these intermediate forms actually lived and died during all those 30 million years? Billions of billions. Right now, they estimate a billion herring live in our oceans. A billion billion. Well, I'm not saying at all times there's a billion billion of these things, but there's a considerable population. Literally, billions of billions of these things lived and died. Now, all we have to do is find three or four as fossils scattered through time, and that would be enough to document evolution. Just three or four. And that would be true, you see, of all of these transitional stages, all the transitions into the millions of species. The number of transitional forms would be enormous. As a matter of fact, when we dig down and dig up fossils, even if we didn't want to, we would find transitional forms. That is what we'd expect on the basis of the theory of evolution. All right. Now, you see, the predictions are very different. Now wouldn't you expect it to be a rather simple thing for scientists to dig up these fossils, clean them up, examine them, study them, classify them, and then on the basis of the evidence to decide which model is true? The predictions are so very different. One model says all of a sudden we're going to have complex animals and we're going to have all different kinds, but we're not going to have any transitional forms. The other model says we're going to start with little simple things and they're slowly, gradually changing more and more complex things, enormous number of transitional forms. It should be a simple matter to do that. As a matter of fact, ladies and gentlemen, it is a simple matter. If scientists could be purely objective about this question of creation and evolution, if all scientists could say, look, it doesn't make one bit of difference to me which is true, creation or evolution. I'm just going to look at the evidence. I'm going to compare the evidence to the predictions I make on the basis of creation model, the evolution model, and then I'm going to decide which one is true. Ladies and gentlemen, there wouldn't be any contest. Creation would win hands down. Because the actual fossil evidence is remarkably in accord with the predictions of a creation model, but contrasts so sharply to predictions based upon our evolution model that the choice would be a simple matter. Now let me, for example, quote from some of the evolutionary literature as to the general nature of the fossil record. Now we creationists are often accused of quoting out of context. You see, we can quote so many statements that are so damaging to evolutionary theory, one defense is merely to accuse the creationists of quoting out of context. Now, ladies and gentlemen, let me make clear. The literature that I'm quoting from is written by evolutionists. They do believe in evolution. They don't buy creation. But I'm going to quote these evolutionists as to the nature of the facts. They state certain facts, and I'm going to use those facts. Now, whether they agree with our conclusions as to how to interpret these facts, that's immaterial. We just want to lay out the facts. And fortunately, there are enough evolutionists that are honest and candid and willing to state the facts. even though they may be damaging to their own philosophy or their own position. One of these is Dr. E.J. H. Corner. Dr. Corner is a professor of botany at Cambridge University. As I mentioned, Dr. Corner is an evolutionist. He's not willing to accept creation or to give up his evolutionary philosophy. But Dr. Corner wrote the chapter called Evolution in the book Contemporary Botanical Thought, published by Quadrangle Books of Chicago, 1961. Dr. Corner, on page 97, makes the following statement. Much evidence can be adduced in favor of the theory of evolution from biology, biogeography, and paleontology. But I still think that, to the unprejudiced, the fossil record of plants is in favor of spatial creation. Unquote. Now notice what this evolutionist says. The fossil record of plants is not in favor of evolution, but it's in favor of creation. You see, if he were free, just as a scientist, to say, all right, here's the evidence, now which way am I going to vote, creation or evolution? He'd vote for creation. But he can't do it because he is unwilling to accept God as creator. The fact that God created our universe. He must somehow try to make the evidence fit, although he says the evidence really does not fit. Now, why does he say that? Well, because the major plant kinds appear abruptly, without ancestors and without transitional form. Darwin called the origin of flowering plants that abominable mystery. And today, the origin of flowering plants is still called that abominable mystery. I have in my ballet case one of the Oxford biology readers entitled The Mysterious Origin of Flowering Plants. They don't know where flowering plants came from. They can't trace their ancestry. They can't find the intermediate forms. And so it is, not only with flowering plants, with seed-bearing plants and other major plant kinds. That fossil record agrees with the prediction we make on the basis of creation. But it presents some great difficulties and mysteries to evolutionists. Now here I have with me an article, or an excerpt from article published in the journal Evolution, volume 28, 1974, just last year. This article is written by Dr. David B. Kitts. It's entitled Paleontology and Evolutionary Theory. Now, paleontology, as you understand, is the study of the fossil record. A paleontologist is a scientist who studies fossils. Dr. Kitts is an evolutionist. He got his training under George Gaillard Simpson, the world's most famous evolutionist. He published this article in the journal Evolution. Kitts is a professor at the University of Oklahoma. One thing that makes this article of a special interest to me is the fact that Dr. Kitts was one of the two evolutionists that Dr. Morris and I debated on the campus of the University of Oklahoma about 2 years before he published this article. And during the debate, Dr. Kitts turned to us and said, well, the gaps are real and they are a problem. Now here, 2 years later, Dr. Kitts published this article in the journal Evolution. On page 467, Dr. Kitts makes the following statement. Despite the bright promise that paleontology provides a means of seeing evolution, it has presented some nasty difficulties for evolutionists, the most notorious of which is the presence of gaps in the fossil record. Evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology does not provide them. Unquote. So Dr. Kitts says then that evolution requires intermediate forms between species, and paleontology, or the fossil record, does not provide them. Now, ladies and gentlemen, when some evolutionists make these statements, there are transitional forms. We do have some examples. I think, why in the world would Dr. Kitts make such a statement? He's an evolutionist. He's a professor at the University of Oklahoma. He published this in the journal Evolution. You see, Dr. Kitts is not so convinced. He says the fossil record evolution requires transitional forms, and the fossil record doesn't provide them. Now, that's a simple statement of fact, you see. I think that says it all. We could really just dismiss this portion of the meeting as far if we could depend on Dr. Kitts. But I want to document a little further, a little more than that. Finally, let me quote from another evolutionist. Then we're going to look at some slides and some of the specific examples. I have a quotation here from Dr. Goldschmidt. Now, Dr. Kitts' statement was was published last year. Dr. Cornish was in 1961, and this is 1952. Some say, oh, well, you're using old literature. Listen, the fossil record hasn't changed in 20 years. The same old fossils are still there. The gaps are still there. And Kitz says, the transitional forms aren't there. I like to use this statement because Dr. Goldschmidt was one of the most avowed evolutionists I have ever read. He says evolution is a fact for which no further proof is needed. And then in this article and in a book he published, he simply proceeds to demolish the theory of evolution because Dr. Goldschmidt did not accept this idea of slow and gradual evolution. The accumulation of micromutations, the neo-Darwinian interpretation of evolution, which is accepted by practically every evolutionist in the world today. But Dr. Goldschmidt, he just couldn't buy that. You see, he saw the gaps. He said they're real. He accepted the gaps as real. He said, look, this neo-Darwinian idea of evolution would require all these transition forms. We don't find them. Here are the major kinds of plants and animals that appear instantaneously without intermediate forms. That doesn't fit this idea of slow and gradual evolution. Well, now, Goldschmidt was not about to give up the faith and become a creationist, so he proposed an alternative mechanism for evolution that he called the hopeful monster mechanism. Goldschmidt proposed, for example, that at one time, a reptile ate an egg. And guess what? A bird came crawling out of that egg. That's what he said. Now, believe me, that's exactly what he said. And he said, every time you see one of these gaps, that's what happened. Something laid an egg, something else got born. Well, now, may I point out, first of all, what a tremendous shock that must have been to Mama Reptile. I mean, in good faith, you lay a good reptilian egg, and some strange critter like that comes crawling out of the egg. I think it would have been a greater shock to Papa Reptile. He probably was suitor for divorce. Well, the neo-Darwinists, the people who believe in slow and gradual evolution, they didn't think Goldschmidt had a better idea either. Fact is, they prefer to believe that he's the one that laid the egg. And they say there's not a shred of evidence to support his hopeful monster mechanism. Well, Goldschmidt said, that's right. No one has ever seen anything like this happen. But he said, isn't that rather cheap criticism? For after all, he said, neither has anyone ever seen one animal slowly and gradually evolve into another. No one has ever seen that happen either. Well, of course, we agree with both Goldschmidt and the neo-Darwinists. No one has ever seen any kind of evolution. But Goldschmidt, he was a dyed-in-the-wool evolutionist. Why did he feel compelled to propose this incredible hopeful monster mechanism? Why? Because you cannot find the transitional form. The gaps are there, and they are real. Listen to what this man says. In The American Scientist, Volume 40, January of 1952, on page 97, Dr. Goldschmidt says, concerning the fossil record, quote, the facts of greatest general importance are the following. When a new phylum, class, or order appears, there follows a quick explosive, in terms of geological time, diversification. So that, practically all orders or families known appear suddenly and without any apparent transition, unquote. So Dr. Goldschmidt is saying, phyla, classes, orders, and down to and including almost every family appear in the fossil record abruptly and without apparent transitional forms. Now, ladies and gentlemen, did you ever hear of a better description of the fossil record that one would predict on the basis of creation than this actual description of the fossil record by this evolutionist? I couldn't describe more explicitly what I'd expect the fossil record to show on the basis of creation than what this evolutionist says the actual fossil record shows. A little later on the same page, Dr. Goldschmidt goes on to say, moreover, within the slowly evolving series, like the famous horse series, the decisive steps are abrupt, without transition. Yes, what about the horses? Well, we have, for example, we have grazing horses and we have browsing horses. Horses that had teeth that demonstrated that they were browsers, nibbled on the foliage of trees and so forth and bark of trees. Other horses that were grazers that ate grass. But I tell you one thing we don't have. We don't have any intermediate form. We don't have horses showing teeth gradually changing from a browsing form to a grazing form. We have some horses with one toed and three toed, but you can't find the intermediate form, one grade into the other. You have different kinds of horses, but you do not have intermediate forms, as Dr. Goldschmidt attests. Well, that's the general nature of the fossil record, ladies and gentlemen. Now let's take a look at some specific examples. Now, let's leave the question, the age of the earth, so forth, until later, so we can deal with them tomorrow, any question, answers, and so forth. Let's say, all right, we're going to assume that the earth is billions of years old. This is what evolutionists assume. We're going to make all the assumptions evolutionists make. We're going to take a look now at the actual scientific evidence in the light of these assumptions. On the basis of these assumptions, the evolutionist says that the oldest sedimentary rocks, the oldest geological deposits in which indisputable multicellular forms of life are found are those known as Cambrian rocks. Now, the evolutionists believe that these rocks were laid down beginning about 600 million years ago. The rocks weren't being laid down, but the sediment was being laid down, which formed the rock. And in the sediment was trapped certain animals that became fossils. Now, in these so-called, he believes that started about 600 million years ago. Now, in these rocks, we find a tremendous number of the fossils of complex form. May we have that next slide, please? Now, we may want to dim the lights a little bit further, please. So we've got a few colored slides showing. Now, can you sharpen that up just a little bit better, Paul? All right. Now, here on this slide, you went the wrong way. You want to come back a little bit? Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Now, this slide was taken from the... Now, can we turn out these lights, these spotlights right here, please? And then you may want to bring the lights up back out there a little bit more. That's fine. Bring those up just a little bit more. I obtained this slide from the Chicago or from the American Museum of Natural History, and it shows some of these animals that are found in these so-called Cambrian rock. Here, for example, there's trilobites. Now, the trilobites are very, very complex creatures, very complex creatures. Here's the branching sponges. Here's some jellyfish. Here's a swimming crustacean. Here's a sea urchin. And there were worms and brachiopods and these seaweeds, all kinds of very complex creatures. Now, these animals are so complex that evolutionary biologists have estimated their evolutionary origin would have required 1.5 billion years. 1.5 billion years, 1,500 million years of slow, gradual evolution. We find billions and billions and billions of fossils in these Cambrian rocks on every continent of the world. Now, if evolution is true, then certainly in the pre-Cambrian rocks, in the rocks that are supposed to be older than the Cambrian, we'd expect to find a tremendous number of fossils. The fossils of the ancestors of these animals. Hundreds of these species had hard parts. Now, if they evolved, one thing is certain, they all didn't invent hard parts at the same time. Those parts would have been evolving for tens of millions of years in the past. Their very life existence depended upon those hard parts. It's incredible to believe that they just simply came from soft-bodied creatures. The pre-Cambrian should have a very rich fossil record. We do find fossils of soft-bodied animals. The jellyfish and worm and even microorganisms are reported from the rocks. Well, what do we find in these pre-Cambrian rocks? Dr. Preston Cloud, one of the world's leading geologists, in an article that he published in the journal Geology, Volume 1, November of 1973, said that as far as he is concerned, we have yet to find a single, indisputable, multicellular fossil in a pre-Cambrian rock. Not one unquestionable fossil of a multicellular animal has ever been found in one of these so-called pre-Cambrian rocks. Now, they found what they believe to be fossils of microorganisms, single-celled, microscopic bacteria and algae. But, of course, there's a monumental gap between a microscopic single-cell form of life and these very complex creatures. And listen, there's not one single unquestionable fossil found anywhere in between. Without fear of contradiction, we can say that no one has ever found the evolutionary ancestor of these creatures. Of the trilobite classification. This article was the presidential address given by Dr. Errol White in 1966. He'd been elected to the president of the Linnaean Society of London. In this article, it was published in the Proceedings of the Linnaean Society of London on page 8, Dr. White made some rather interesting observations. He says, the subject of his talk was lungfishes. And he says on page 8, but whatever ideas authorities may have on the subject, the lungfishes, like every other major group of fishes that I know, have their origins firmly based in nothing. And he italicized the word nothing. A little later he says, I have often thought how little I should like to have to prove organic evolution in a court of law. And then he says down here a little bit later, he says, we still do not know the mechanics of evolution, in spite of the overconfident claims in some quarters. Nor are we likely to make further progress in this by the classical methods of paleontology or biology. And we shall certainly not advance matters by jumping up and down and shrilling, Darwin is God, and I, so-and-so, am his prophet. And then he closes his article by saying, the recent researches of workers like Dean and Henschelwood, he gives the reference, already suggest the possibility of incipient cracks in the seemingly monolithic walls of the neo-Darwinian Jericho. Well, well, well. He's calling neo-Darwinism, the modern theory of evolution, Jericho. And he says there's some incipient cracks in the walls of Jericho. It sounds as if maybe he's expecting those walls to come down. Now, this man is an evolutionist, but he is saying, frankly, here's what the situation is, you see. Isn't it amazing when we find some of these evolutionists that are candid and fair enough to just really lay out the evidence? All right, now, next slide, please. Now, again, we may want to... All right, now, here is the fish that is supposed to have given rise to the amphibians. In the lower part of the slide, you see a reconstruction of what is supposed to be the world's oldest known amphibian. Now, you can turn these lights out. Maybe some lights. All right, thank you. Now, why do evolutionists believe this fish gave rise to this amphibian? Well, now, I'll tell you why. I'll tell you the number one reason they've selected it as the ancestor. They haven't found anything better. That's the first reason. That's not very good, but that's the best they can find. Why did they select this fish? Well, he was a lungfish. But that's not very definitive because there are many lungfishes. Lungfish is in existence right today. When the water becomes stagnant, they can come to the surface of the air and gulp some air. When the water becomes stagnant, they can gulp a few breaths of air. The lungfishes, the real lungfishes, as far as I've ever been able to discover, never leave the water. They never leave the water. But they will gulp air once in a while. But you see, they're still in existence today. And as Dr. White pointed out, you trace them right back to nothing. But what else about this fish? Well, this fish, you notice, he has some bones in the fins, which evolutionists believe could be transformed into the feet and legs of the amphibian. Of course, you notice that he had three other fins, which also had bones, but apparently he found a way to get rid of those, leaving the others to evolve into feet and legs. Now, also, there's some similarity in the vertebrae. There's much we could say about that if we had time. That just completely contradictory. And there are some similarities in the skull pattern. Now, there's many dissimilarities in the skull pattern as well. But that is the nature of the evidence that evolutionists say that amphibian is linked to that fish. And believe it or not, here are two examples of their transitional form. They say, oh, we have some transitional forms. Here's that fish and that amphibian. They're a transitional form. Now, look, ladies and gentlemen, that fish was a fish. He had a lovely set of fish fins, highly designed for balancing and steering and locomotion in the water. On the other hand, this amphibian had the basic amphibian limb. He had feet and legs. And there's not a trace of an intermediate stage, in spite of the 30 million years of evolution, supposedly, that took place along the way. Not one single transitional form. There's no halfway fins and halfway feet and legs. There's nothing in between. Next slide, please, and we'll see another basic difference between the fish and the amphibian. This was taken from an exhibit in the Chicago Museum of Natural History. This is not a creationist interpretation here. The exhibit points out the cross-section of the fish at the pelvic region. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is true of all fishes, living or fossil. The fins serve only for balancing and steering. The pelvic bones are small and loosely embedded in muscle. There is no connection between the pelvic bones of fish and the vertebral column. You don't need any connection. The fins do not support the weight of the body. There are no walking fish, now or ever. The walking catfish of Florida doesn't walk. It can slither along on its belly using the same type of motion it uses in the water. After all, it has to. That's the only kind of muscles it has. It can slither along on its belly. Once in a while, it can get up on its tail and flip head over heels, so to speak, and make a few, 3 or 4 feet at a time. But it can't walk. It can't. It's not made to walk. But notice now the cross-section of the amphibian at the pelvic region. The limbs do support the weight of the body. The pelvic bones are very large, and they're firmly attached to the vertebral column. That is the anatomy you must have in order to walk. That's the anatomy possessed by all amphibians, living or fossil. And again, there are no transitional forms in the fossil record. How could it be that we could have all of that evolution over all those millions of years, all of those billions upon billions upon billions of intermediate forms, and yet none can be found in the fossil record? I think this is clear evidence that those fishes and those amphibians were clearly, are distinctly, separately created. Next slide, please. Now, another interesting aspect to this so-called transition is that the fish, the Crotsotherigian fish that supposedly gave rise to the amphibians, was believed to have become extinct 70 million years ago. It evolved about 300 million years or so ago, was around on the earth for a couple hundred million years or more, and then it became extinct. Because in rocks that are supposed to be 70 million years or younger, no fossils of this fish have ever been found. But in 1938, lo and behold, they found this fish alive and well off the coast of Africa. And since that time, they have taken several dozen of these fishes, and here he is. Here's the fish, ladies and gentlemen. Well, he's the same old fish. He just forgot to evolve. He's just been around all these millions of years. Now, isn't it rather strange? He's been so stable from his very first appearance in the fossil record some 300 million years ago. He's still the same fish 70 million years ago, they say, according to their dating method. And even today, he's still the same fish. But some of his real close kin evolved all the way to man in the meantime. Now, that does seem rather strange. And doesn't it seem rather incredible that that creature could be around 70 million years and leave no fossils? I think there's something wrong with the 70 million years. And there are invertebrates, supposedly 300 million years old, that they have recently discovered. That is, for 300 million years, they find no fossils. In rocks, 300 million years or younger, no fossils of these invertebrates have ever been found. But the invertebrates are still alive today. They've been found in the bottom of Long Island Sound, off the coast of South America, places like that. Again, I think something perhaps may be wrong with the 300 million years. Next slide, please. Now, here's a creature believed by Dr. Romer and many other evolutionists to be the ancestor of birds, flying reptiles, and dinosaurs. In a moment, we're going to look at the origin of flight. But first, we want to take a look at dinosaurs. Now, here's the ancestor. Now, this reptile is supposed to be ancestral to the dinosaurs. Next slide, please. Well, here's a rather strange dinosaur, a Triceratops dinosaur. This creature's about 15 feet long, so, or maybe 20 feet or so, and he had these huge spikes. He had three spikes here, two here above the orbits. He had this spike on the nasal area, and he had this huge armor plate, bone several inches thick. So he was a most formidable creature. I'm sure some of these meat-eating dinosaurs came after him. He'd just gore them with those spikes. He would be protected by this huge armor. Wouldn't he make a tremendous tackle on the San Francisco 49ers football team or the Oakland Raiders? He'd make a tremendous tackle. It'd be hard to run a play through this guy. Well,
He could have used him when the Oakland played Pittsburgh. Well, in any case, he has some very unique structures. Now, that, according to the evolutionary story, you see, he evolved very slowly and gradually. We ought to find, now, we find some of these horned dinosaurs with a single spike. We have some with the three. But we don't have any dinosaurs with little bitty spikes, you see. Some just beginning to merge and growing and becoming longer and longer. You either find a horned dinosaur with horns, or you don't find any horned dinosaurs, you see. They're complete. And the armor is complete. There are no intermediate forms whatsoever. Next slide, please. Now, here's a Stegosaurus dinosaur. And you see this poor little fellow, he was so confused in all of his evolution, the spikes ended up on the tail out here. He had four spikes here that are about 3 feet long and about six inches here at the base. 4 feet long. And then he had these armor plates. Well, we don't know whether they're armor plates or heat exchangers or what they were. There's a disagreement among the paleontologists what purpose was served by these spikes. Notice this little old head on this creature. He had a brain about the size of a walnut. He sure would be at the foot of his class. Down here in the hip area, he had an enlargement of the spinal cord about 20 times as big as the brain, which was believed to direct the tail area and the legs and so forth and so on. Not a real brain, but he had what is people call a second brain, but merely a nerve center here for the legs and tail. But look how different he was than any reptile or any other dinosaur. But there are no intermediate forms. We do not find a single intermediate form showing these plates slowly and gradually coming to being, or these spikes slowly and gradually evolving. Look at the little head on that creature, so different than Triceratops, so very different, but no intermediate form. And there were a number of other armored dinosaurs, very different, remarkably different. But listen, you find those armored dinosaurs appearing abruptly, and no transitional forms can be found. Next slide, please. Now, here's a Trachodon dinosaur. Trachodon was an example of the duck-billed dinosaurs. This dinosaur, you see, according to the evolutionary story, the front part of his jaws and teeth evolved into a duck bill. And the backside of his jaw, he had about 2,000 teeth, 500 on each side of the upper and lower jaw, one on top of the other. But the front portion was a duck bill, and his feet were rather webbed, very large creature, standing perhaps 18 or 20 feet high, a very huge creature, and he used that duck bill, no doubt, to gather up vegetation off the bottoms of lakes and streams. And he had this particular dinosaur has a knob right here. His nostril was located right on the top of his head. So all he had to do is raise that head up and take a breath of air. Well, he's an unusual dinosaur, very unusual. But listen, where are the transitional forms? Where are the transitional forms showing the duck-billed dinosaur evolving? There are none whatsoever. We have varieties of duck-billed dinosaurs, but there are no intermediates. Next slide, please. And here we have one example of the carnivorous dinosaurs. This was Allosaurus. Oh, standing about 20 feet high or so, rather large creature, tremendous carnivorous dinosaur feasting on the remnants of a brontosaurus. Then there was a Tyrannosaurus rex, the fiercest of them all, the tyrant lizard. Tyrannos, meaning tyrant, and saurus, meaning lizard. The tyrant lizard, a great meat-eating dinosaur. But again, there are no transitional forms between any reptile and these carnivorous dinosaurs. Next slide, please. And here's the brontosaurus, a creature weighing about 40 tons of steaks and roast, walking around on 4 feet, consuming hundreds of pounds of food every day. A very large creature, but not the largest of them all. The largest of them all is shown in the next slide. Next slide, please. Here's Brachiosaurus. This Brachiosaurus dinosaur was a huge creature, weighing somewhere between 80 and 90 tons, 160,000 to 180,000 pounds. He had this very long neck, very large creature, a huge creature. But with Brachiosaurus, as with the giraffe, you either find the long-necked Brachiosaurus or you don't find any Brachiosaurus. You either find a long-necked giraffe or you don't find any giraffe. There are no intermediate forms showing a gradual increase in the length of the neck. You either find one or you find the other, but you do not find any intermediate form. Now, people often ask, what happened to the dinosaurs? Why don't we have dinosaurs today? Ladies and gentlemen, we believe that the dinosaurs became extinct because of the tremendous change brought upon the earth at the time of the flood. We believe that the flood is described in Genesis to be a real historical event of worldwide effect. One effect would be that you would have a tremendous decrease in the amount of water vapor scattered through the millions of cubic miles of in the space surrounding the earth. You see, the Bible tells us that it rained very hard for 40 days and 40 nights and longer. Now, if you condense every bit of moisture in our present atmosphere, all you could get is 1 inch of rain distributed evenly around the earth. Quite obviously, then, if that flood is a real historical event, there was a much, much greater quantity of water vapor in the atmosphere than there is today. Now, water vapor has a powerful effect in absorbing and retaining solar radiation. It is by far the most important constituent of our atmosphere in absorbing and retaining solar heat. That's why our atmosphere, why Earth has a mild climate, why we don't have the extremes of heat and cold that we find on the planets with no atmosphere, and the moon and other planets that have no atmosphere, extreme 600 to 700 degrees difference between night and day. We don't have that because we have the atmosphere which absorbs and retains that solar heat. And of the gases in the atmosphere, water vapor is by far the most important. Now, if before the flood we had much, much more water vapor in the atmosphere, it would have created what is commonly called a greenhouse effect, or we might call it an atmosphere effect. It would have absorbed more solar heat, retained more, and would have given our Earth a worldwide mild climate. As a matter of fact, there are many facts of geology demonstrate that the world did have a very mild climate at one time, worldwide. Greenland at one time had a mild climate, a subtropical climate. Fossils of temperate plants and animals are found scattered all over the world. We find coal and oil in the Arctic and the Antarctic. You see, at one time the world had a climate very different than it has today. Why? Evolutionary geologists do not know why. Even if you had all the continents together as one giant continent, as it is now being postulated today, you still have climatic zones. What has caused this change? What brought in the Ice Age and so forth and so on? We believe it was a change brought in by the flood. This worldwide mild climate vanished. The lush vegetation that covered most of the world was gone. And the dinosaurs and thousands of other species could not survive under these drastically changed conditions. They became rapidly extinct. Thousands of species, in addition to dinosaurs, have become extinct. Now, we believe that this provides the answer for the mass extinction that is witnessed on our earth today. And by the way, the Bible in Job chapter 40, in verse 15, describes the behemoth. Sounds very much like a dinosaur. It has bones like bars of iron, its sinews of brass, a mammoth creature, a tail like a cedar, and so forth and so on, drinketh up a river. Now, some have postulated that description of an elephant. Well, I don't think so, because have you ever seen the tail of an elephant? Doesn't look like a cedar, does it? Well, we think that this indicates that Job and his friends had an actual memory. At least they had heard of creatures such as a dinosaur. Well, in any case, they have become extinct. We believe the Bible does provide a very reasonable answer. Next slide, please. Now, here again is the creature believed to have been ancestral to dinosaurs, flying reptiles, and the birds. Now, flight should provide an ideal test case for creation versus evolution. Why? Well, you got to have some tremendous changes to change a non-flying animal into flying animal. Therefore, the transitional form should be especially obvious, should be easily identified. We should be able to identify them if we can find them. Secondly, flight occurs in four classes of animals: in mammals, the bat being the flying mammal; in insects, birds; and extinct flying reptiles. So there's four classes of animals, multiplied opportunities to find transitional form. Let's see what the fossil record shows. Next slide, please. Well, here's an example of the flying reptiles. Notice the revolutionary difference between the structure of this flying reptile and his so-called ancestor. Notice, for example, this very long tail equipped with a rudder. Notice the very large keel for the anchoring of the flight muscles. Notice these wing membranes. Of course, he had flight muscles. And notice particularly the fingers of this reptile. Now, that thing up there is not a finger. This reptile had four fingers. According to evolutionary theory, you see, three fingers remain the normal length, but look what happened to that fourth finger. Through blind, accidental, random chance mutations, it began to get longer, and then it got longer, and longer, and longer, and longer, through millions of years of time. Other blind, random, accidental mutations generated the flight membrane, the wing membrane, the flight muscles, the hollow bones, the large keel, and eventually we had this marvelous flying machine. Next slide, please. Now, here is the example of the pterodactyloid kind of flying reptiles. For example, here is a pteranodon. The pteranodon had this huge toothless beak, about 3 feet long. You see, his jaws and teeth evolved into a toothless beak. And some little knob on his head evolved into this large bony crest. And notice in this case, the fourth fingers supported a wingspread of up to 52 feet. Just recently, they found several fossils of this creature in the state of, well, where else? In the state of Texas, with this tremendous wingspread, 52 feet. Do you know that's 14 feet longer than the F-4 Phantom jet? Now, I don't know about you, but I'm glad that critter is extinct. You ladies wouldn't dare allow your little children to go out and to play with that huge creature around. But now, if this creature evolves slowly and gradually, it seemed to me we'd find a few intermediates showing the jaws and teeth evolving into the toothless beak and the bony crest evolving, and some intermediate stages in the gradual lengthening of the finger. As a matter of fact, ladies and gentlemen, there is not one single transitional form of any kind. Not a trace of an intermediate stage has ever been found between these flying reptiles and their so-called non-flying ancestors. Not a trace of an intermediate stage. Millions and millions of years of evolution. Many of these things are found, but no intermediate forms. All of a sudden, here you have these remarkable flying reptiles and no intermediates. Next slide, please. Now, here is the Archaeopteryx, supposed to be the world's oldest known bird. Now, here is another one of these very, very rare examples of what evolutionists say are transition forms. Now, obviously, Kitsch doesn't believe it, but some do. And this is the thing that's brought up repeatedly, time after time after time. We hear Archaeopteryx, Archaeopteryx, Archaeopteryx. Listen, if evolution is true, these evolutionists have so many transitional forms, they'd have them running out of their ears. But they keep appealing to Archaeopteryx, Archaeopteryx, Archaeopteryx. You see, it's one of the very, very rare things that they claim is a transitional form. But look at this creature. What is he? He's a bird, isn't he? He has wings. He's completely feathered. He had perching feet, a bird-like skull. He flew. No question he was a bird. He's classified as a bird by all the paleontologists. Now, these feathers, as a matter of fact, were just as complex as the feathers found in a modern bird. And feathers are extremely complex structures, incredibly complex. And these feathers were just as complex as the feathers found in a modern bird. Now, the Archaeopteryx, unlike modern birds, did have teeth. And he does have claws, or did have claws, and vertebrae extending out along the tail. Now, these are some of the so-called reptilian characteristics of this bird. Well, let's take a second look now at these so-called reptilian features. What about the teeth? Well, it's true that modern birds do not have teeth, and it's true that most reptiles do. So the evolutionist says, see, the teeth came from the reptilian ancestors. But ladies and gentlemen, there were other ancient birds in the fossil record that had no teeth. Some of these ancient birds, they, all of a sudden, here they are, not a trace of a tooth. Some ancient birds had teeth, and some didn't. Now, you see, that's no different than any other of the subclasses of the vertebrates. For some fishes have teeth, but some do not. Some amphibians have teeth, but some do not. Some reptiles have teeth, but some do not. Most mammals have teeth, but some do not. Some of you have teeth, but some do not. But you see, the presence or absence of teeth proves nothing. But what about the claws? Now, that would seem somewhat more definitive. Well, as a matter of fact, ladies and gentlemen, there are at least three birds alive and well today that have claws. Next slide, please. Here is the Hawatzin, a bird living in South America. And you can see he's a pretty good bird. Not 100% bird, as any bird could be. But this bird has claws. Next slide, please. Here's the next slide is a juvenile Hawatzin. Notice that he has two claws. But that bird, if he were found as a fossil, I'm sure someone would claim he's a transitional form between a reptile and a bird. But he's a bird, you see, living right now in this world. The turaco is another bird in Africa that has claws, and the ostrich has claws. The ostrich has three claws that you could actually describe as being more reptile-like than the claws of Archaeopteryx. But, of course, again, the ostrich is a bird. You see, God the Creator gave claws not only to reptiles but to birds as well. And you can see what this bird is using for, a very useful little gadget. He uses them for clinging to branches and so forth. So they're very useful to this bird. Next slide, please. Well, here's a picture of Archaeopteryx again. Same picture, just turned around the opposite direction. Think you're getting something new. Now, let me read quickly from a book called Biology and Comparative Physiology of Birds, edited by A.J. Marshall, published by Academic Press in 1960. Chapter 1 of Volume 1 is written by Dr. W.E. Swinton, an evolutionist of Toronto University, a man who does believe that birds have evolved from reptiles. On page 1 of this chapter, Dr. Swinton's, it's called The Origin of Birds, Dr. Swinton makes the following statement. The origin of birds is largely a matter of deduction. There is no fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved. Unquote. So Dr. Swinton says there is no fossil evidence. One can infer that birds evolved from reptiles, but you cannot find the evidence for it in the fossil record. You have birds and reptiles, but no intermediates. Next slide, please. Well, here's the bat. And by the way, the flying insect, there is no evidence, there are no intermediate forms for the flying insects. Evolutionists argue among themselves what gave rise to wings in an insect. If they could find one single intermediate form, they could settle the argument. But the controversy still rages because no intermediate forms are found. Well, here is the bat. He's a flying mammal, and it is believed, therefore, that he evolved from non-flying mammals. Well, if this is true, then we have to account for the origin of the fingers here, which supports the wing membrane, the origin of the wing membrane itself, the flight muscles, and so forth. All of these unique creatures are characteristics associated with this flying mammal. Now, if that flying mammal has evolved, it seemed to me we ought to find a few intermediates showing the gradual increase of the finger and the origin of the wing membrane and so forth. What do we find? Next slide, please. Here's a picture taken from the cover page of Science magazine, December 9, 1966. In the center, you see the picture of the actual fossil that was found, a fossil bat found in rocks, which the article claimed was 50 million years old. The authors say, we have never found a fossil related in any way to a bat any older than this. This is the oldest bat or anything related to a bat that has ever been found. Now, if the bones are stretched out and clothed with flesh, this is what the reproduction would look like. All right, ladies and gentlemen, there you have him. The world's oldest known bat. And what is he? 100% bat. There has been no change, no evolution of any kind when the first appearance of the bat occurred until the day. The first evidence of flight in mammals is in fully developed bats. And there are no intermediate forms whatsoever. No transitional form and no change since this bat appeared. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you see then here we have all the flying animals, the birds, the flying mammals or the bats, the insects, and the flying reptiles, no intermediate form. Here where we have distinctive differences, where the transitional form should be so obvious, where we should find multiplied numbers of intermediate forms, we find none. So we would agree with Dr. Kitts that evolution requires transitional form and the fossil record doesn't produce it. On the other hand, on the basis of creation, this is exactly the evidence we predicted. This is positive evidence, ladies and gentlemen. This is simply not negative evidence for evolution. It's positively the evidence that we'd expect on the basis of creation. So we say then that evolution, the fossils say no. They support the biblical record of the separate and distinct creation of each kind.